In 1984, George Orwell warned us about a world where truth is distorted, surveillance is constant, and thought itself becomes a crime. He called it a warning, not a prediction, but here we are. Palantir's watching, truth is rewritten, and the word woke, once a cry for awareness, is now weaponized. Orwell fought fascists, warned against communists, and feared authoritarianism on all sides. In this episode, we dive into the man behind the message and ask, has Big Brother finally arrived? Today we're wrapping up our 1984 deep dive series with part three, where we'll finally talk about who George Orwell really was, his journey from wealth into sympathy, his Antifa background, warnings about totalitarianism and authoritarianism, which we'll define, as well as the term woke, right? We're going to finally break down what woke actually means, where it came from, and all kinds of stuff. We're going to finally examine what parts of 1984 are happening today and how the dystopia may already be here, all right? Now, I've been teasing this since the beginning of part one, because what we did was, in case you haven't heard the full 1984 series, which I don't know what you're doing here, you need to start at part one, my friend. We walked through the entire book of 1984, and I told you exactly what happened, pulling out some relevant thoughts, ideas, and theories. Okay. Now, finally, in part three, we're going to wrap it all up, make sense of it, and to do that, we have to understand who George Orwell really was. Okay, because Orwell and the term Orwellian is often used, and I think there's some misconceptions about who he was or what he was trying to, you know, pull off, right? So let's take a look at George Orwell. There's actually, I think, two massive books. I did not read either one. It was too daunting of a task. So I took notes from George Orwell, A Life in Pictures, a documentary from the BBC, all right? And we're going to run through that real quick, and I'm going to talk to you about what was presented, okay? Now, he's important because the Times named him the second greatest British writer since 1945, and this is where the term Orwellian, of course, you know, comes from. And also, you can watch the video of this on YouTube, as of this recording is where I saw it. And it's interesting because I didn't know this, but there's no video of George Orwell or recordings of his voice ever. They used an actor to dramatize, you know, some of these events. Now, he had written an essay, Why I Write, and it was talking about how writing a book is a struggle, like an illness, and one would not take on such a task unless they were driven by a demon to do so. And there's some truth to that, right? There's some truth. I know from writing my books, you got to get into a certain mind state, a certain flow state to successfully write. That's very challenging to do as you get older and more things start popping up on your plate. That's why when you hear about those stereotypes of people going out into the woods or some cabin or some secluded location to write, like, that's the real thing. Like, if I could do that, you better believe I would do that. I think if I could hole up somewhere for a month, I could knock out a whole book, you know? Life's not that simple, all right? So who was George Orwell? Well, that wasn't his real name, first off. His real name is actually Eric Blair. He was born in June 25th, 1903, born into an upper middle class family. He was at a boarding school by the age of eight. And he wrote about all this experience at the boarding school, where he would wet his bed and he would pray to God to stop wetting his bed, but he continued to do so, right? And he realized that he could commit a sin without any way of not doing so, which I think would get into some of this ideas of religion, because, you know, a lot of people who become atheists and stuff, they say, well, God doesn't listen to me, and I asked for all these things and he gave me awful experiences instead. And I think that happens, right? He thought, well, it's impossible for me to be good. So this sort of planted seeds of rebellion, okay? And at the time, his family and other people like him in the upper middle class, they looked down on commoners, the common folk, the poor. They were considered subhuman, all right? So that was kind of what baked Eric Blair, a.k.a. George Orwell. He then went on to another school called Eaton. He ends up becoming an adult and joins the police force. And this is when he has this realization of the imperialism of Britain in countries like India. And he didn't like that. For the first time, he understands that there is an oppression in this system. Even though he was born into the higher end of things, he wasn't vibing with it. He's like, I don't really dig this, you know? Meanwhile, he had always had this drive to write. Since the age of a child, he was interested in writing. He had an illness. They think it was tuberculosis, but back then, people were afraid of being quarantined, so they didn't get tested. Sounds familiar. And he would... he always had this, like, this weird illness about him. Eventually, he moves to Paris, and he's writing. He's not able to sell any of it, but he has this passion for it, so he continues to do so. And he, even though he came from an upper-middle-class family with this education and such, he was, you know, poor. He was washing dishes, but he was very happy. Even with all these failures of writing, he was still happy. And this, you know, a lot of this sounds like the story of the Siddhartha Buddha, who was born into this extreme wealth in this palace, and one day the Buddha decides he wants to sort of like go out and see the world that they were trying to protect him from seeing. And he was like, dude, these people are poor. And that was what started him on this meditation journey. So Eric Blair moves back to London, and now he's living, of course, with, you know, with the poors and the criminals and so on, right? And he wrote a book about his experience and observations about being down and out and living with the poor. And he sent it to a publisher. They liked it. And he decides he's going to write this under an alias now. And he chooses the name George Orwell based upon King George and a river that was named Orwell. And his experience told him that homeless people aren't as... That homeless people are demonized, basically. They're not all drug addicts and alcoholics, which is kind of the common trope. That's kind of the stereotype of what we believe, particularly here in America, right? And the data I found, because I looked into this, because I remember taking a social problems course in college, and we talked about the homeless problem, and I forget all the statistics, but it was like kind of alarming to me, right? And I've told this story in the past about working at a homeless soup kitchen, and the short version, we were working and lunch started at 10:30. So we're standing there waiting for the kitchen, and just like one family come through, and there was a bunch of people standing outside. I say to the lady running the thing, I said, hey, why are they coming in? She says, oh, like we just let the families in first from 10:30 to 11. And then 11, we let the, you know, the singles in or whatever. I said, oh, I was like, oh, well, there's only like one family here. And she was like, well, no, there's actually several families here. And I said, well, where are they? And she says, they're at work. I said, what? They're at work. Excuse me? And that's real talk. That's real talk, because I also was programmed to believe like, oh, homeless people, they're just lazy, addicted to drugs, alcoholics, and all this stuff, right? Which I'm not saying that doesn't exist. It's just a misrepresentation of the homeless community, right? And so I wanted to back that up with some facts. I always mention this, and I never back it up. So I went on, I tried to find it online. Surprisingly hard to find. So I go to ChatGPT. I'm like, this is what I'm looking for. Give me some answers. And the data it pulled was from 2023. So take that with a grain of salt. But some of the stats are 28% of the people that are homeless are actually full-on families with children and such, right? 29% of homeless are women. I'm sure that means like singles. I don't really know. But it's not all just like drug addicted men, right? 29% of, because my whole thing is like, as a man, I was raised to, you know, want to take care of women and children. You know what I mean? Like that, I was raised with that sort of, I don't know, etiquette of some kind. So, like, that's upsetting to me. Not to say that, like, it's not a tragedy when a man is homeless, but, like, I don't know. There's a certain thing where I'm like, I wish we could take care of the women and children. So there's actually a lot of homeless women is what I'm saying. 6% of homeless are veterans, which veterans only represent, I think it's, like, 1% of the population. I could be wrong about that. Now, throw that fact away. I should look that one up. But the craziest statistic is that 40 to 45% of homeless people are actually working. That's almost half. It's probably at that mark now by 2025, given everything going on. Almost half of the homeless people are working jobs. And this is a major problem. Major issue. I'm not going to get on my soapbox of, you know, Bernie Sanders socialism talk, but it's a problem. All right. Now, when you talk about the mental illness being a component, which is obviously a component, I know because when I went to Austin, I did on Breaking Social Norms, I did a show about our experience going to Austin, Texas, and how a homeless guy charged at me and I tripped over this. I was looking at him and I tripped over a Lime scooter in the street and it ripped my entire toenail off, which was super fun. And I was like, these homeless people are out of control in Austin. You know, the dude was like yelling at me and charging at me. I was like, what the hell? And I just kind of kept walking because we were walking towards each other and I didn't look. I was looking at him. I was like, is this motherfucker about to do something? And I wasn't looking and I had flip flops on and I smashed it into a scooter. Didn't even realize that I ripped my toenail off until I got past him because he was like crazy. Anyway, that's 25 to 30% of homeless people have mental illness. 35 to 40% have substance abuse problems, okay? And then we get to the number of chronic homeless. These are the people that you see living on the streets. These are the ones charged at me when I ripped my toenail off in Austin. These are the ones that you drive around. This is the ones you think about when you hear about homeless people. This is only 22% of the homeless population. And what that means is there's tons of people out there are working, families, women, children, veterans, the people we say we take care of in our society that are homeless. They're living in cars. They're trying to figure it out. They're trying to get into the shelters. So the large majority are not drug addicted, chronic homeless people at all, right? Some suggestions say that if we want to fix the homeless issue in America, one way you could do it, you could just build homes for all the homeless people, right? Which I get it. Like, that's not very fair because a lot of us work for our stuff, but like, they're already working. They're already working. Most of them are already working families. But throw all the socialist communist fears out of your mind for 5 seconds. What I'm saying is that if you said, look, there's a problem with people living on the streets. We don't like that. I don't want families and working adults with children living on the streets. We don't want that. We need to fix that. Let's say we're just going to hand them a house, theoretically. Let's build a house and hand it to them, a condo, whatever. To do that would cost about $20 billion a year. $20 billion, that's a ton of money. That's a scary amount of money, right? But when you zoom out and look at everything else that we, our entire culture, that we actually spend our money on, in America, we're very wealthy. We just choose not to spend it on these things because our politicians are in a revolving door with all kinds of lobbyists and they love to make enemies and demonize people and do all kinds of crazy stuff, right? This is we're the most propagandized culture in history. The mainstream media is owned by billionaires. The whole system is just fraught with abuse. So you probably think, well, Isaac, I don't want to spend $20 billion on giving people free homes. And I get that. I get that. But guess how much we spend on the defense right now, or war, the Department of War, I guess. $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. $1 trillion a year. So we're saying if we just spend $20 billion a year, I would still have a toenail, right? That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying. $20 billion to put all these homeless working families into a place where they can live versus $100 billion, basically, or $1,000 billion, I should say. So $1,000 billion, which is a trillion, for defense versus $20 billion for homeless. All right? That's my leftist propaganda for you for the day. All right? Because a lot of people, they get upset. They drive around the big cities like, what? All these homeless tent cities is crazy. And it is crazy. I'm with you. I'm actually with you on that. I don't like that. It makes people uncomfortable. I don't like to see it. Not because I'm like, ew, gross, homeless people. I mean, I said, like, it makes me upset. I hate this for them. I hate that. I wish we had better systems in place. And we can fix it. That's what's crazy. It's like, we totally have the money to fix it. We could just take a little sliver out of the defense budget, just a sliver, and we could fix all that. You don't like the homeless people living under the overpass in your city? You could fix it. We could totally do it. We just choose not to because we like to demonize things, you know, because there's no money in that. There's money in making you scared and fearful of other people and all this and hate and hating people. We could have mental health programs. We could have substance abuse programs. We could have housing. We could have all that. We could have universal health care. We choose not to because we're a bunch of idiots. Anyway, so George Orwell, or Eric Blair, I should say, he moves in with a bunch of leftists, meets his future wife, Irene, starts writing in a bookshop. He writes a book about that, ironically. Leaves, starts a project of writing about middle-class experiences called The Road to Wigan Pier, like how he was working down in a coal mine, and he admires how strong these coal miners are and says, you know, I would have died in a matter of weeks if I had to actually do this for a living. Then he goes into the slums of another town. He sees how poor, unemployed people live there. He talks about how this is all byproduct of industrialism and capitalism. And he sees the tragedy in all this, right? And The Road to Wigan Pier becomes a success. And now he can afford to live off his writing. Well, good for you, buddy. Then he talks, they start focusing in on the driving force of fascism, which he asserts is based off the belief in inequality. The belief in inequality is what that's about. This is very much what the billionaire class wants you to believe, is that we're not all equal, you know? And this is part of Orwell's beliefs that capitalism creates inequality, and the billionaires make you believe that that's okay. The suffering that some of these people have is because they deserve it. And it's ultimately manipulative. He sees fascism taking place in places like Germany. This is like, you know, 1930s, 40s, whatever. And he goes to Barcelona, Spain, where there was a civil war of the working class. And the civil war was the working class fighting off the fascists. And Orwell, of course, joins the working class militia. But what's weird is that during this fight, the communists then lead a counter-revolution, even though they were allies with the working class, the workers' revolution. And the communists basically take over the whole thing, and they force the working class militia to join the communists. And Orwell, at this point, he's still fighting. He's like, okay, whatever, we're on the same side. We're fighting the fascists. And he gets shot in the neck, like 50 Cent. He gets shot. And it misses his artery barely. So he gets discharged from the militia. Meanwhile, the communists are amping up their demands on the workers' revolution militia to keep joining the communists, which is when Orwell gets his first glimpse of totalitarianism, because he sees his militia workers' revolution mates getting imprisoned and even disappearing because they won't join the communists. Because it's, again, the communists and the fascists, they both demand allegiance to their party, right? And this is a major thing with Orwell. He's very much anti-fascist. He's very much Antifa. But more importantly, he's actually anti-authoritarian, regardless of whether the authoritarian figure comes through the left of communism or the right of fascism. And he's defined as a democratic socialist leftist, which is what Bernie is called, right? But they use that term socialist and democrat and leftist, and it's like there's a lot of propaganda, and those are charged terms, right? Those are the boogeymen in America. But he acknowledges that the left can go too far, and that gets into communism, which I agree, you know? He's 100% correct on that. But he said, because he saw with his own eyes and his own friends how terrible the communists were as well. And the communism also leads to this path of authoritarianism and totalitarianism, just like the fascists and the, you know, the right wing does. You got to keep it balanced, right? It's that pendulum swinging. You got to keep it nice and balanced right in the center, baby. So let's define authoritarianism. Because I wanted to be crystal clear on these terms, because I kind of vaguely know the concept of it, right? So authoritarianism is defined as a government system where one leader or a small group holds power and demands obedience. But people may still have some personal freedoms as long as they don't challenge the regime. This is what people believe America is currently sliding into with this dark enlightenment stuff. Some comparable systems include Franco's Spain after the Spanish Civil War. You know, Franco was a military dictator who controlled all the media, got rid of elections, demonized the leftists as enemies of the state so he could get rid of democracy. Right? That sounds like dark enlightenment talk. And George Orwell was, like I said, fought against Franco. He fought against the communists in the workers' revolution. He fought against the fascists, but then also was fighting against the communists and Franco, because Franco and the communists were just as bad as the fascists. And this is what inspired the whole book of 1984. Okay? And authoritarianism is about controlling your actions and your speech. Totalitarianism is a step beyond that. It's about total control, controlling your thoughts. And it's defined as a system that aims to control every aspect of public and private life, including thought, speech, behavior, and even belief. And they execute totalitarianism through the mass surveillance, right? Like that Palantir system that's being rolled out as we speak. And in the totalitarian system, there's no privacy. The state dictates what's reality, what's quote-unquote happening, you know? They're reinventing history. The Epstein files, right? We all see what's going on here, right? Can we all agree that there's a reality where the Epstein files exist and it's not just a hoax? And like we're trying to, and we'll talk about that later on. But, you know, it's more like Nazi Germany, Stalinist USSR. The enemies are erased. They're vaporized like they discuss in the book, 1984. But back to Orwell. He flees Spain in 1936 after getting shot in his neck. You got a dart in your neck. And he says that every word he wrote after that was a warning about totalitarianism. This was his mission now, all right? And at the same time, Hitler's Germany is threatening all of Europe at this very point. So Orwell was very much anti-fascist. He was debating others on whether one should get involved in World War II, and he was blaming Britain and their wealthy elites for not getting involved earlier to stop these Nazis. He also said everyone should have a firearm, so like, you know, he was a pro-Second Amendment kind of guy. He was against the bankers, he was against the elites, and even suggested there should be a violent revolution of patriots against the wealthy. So, like, my man was about that action, right? So he ends up moving to London right before Britain actually does get involved with the war. And he's actually very scared for the future. At this point, he sees people around him in what he calls a twilight sleep. People just drinking at the pub as if everything's fine, everything's normal, there's nothing to worry about. Then he would go on to join the Ministry of Propaganda at the BBC. And his office is in room 101, which obviously all those things should ring major bells and alarms of what we talked about in the book 1984. And it's here where he would read British statist propaganda on the radio. And he said he had watered it down a little bit. He apparently suggested one time that he could chop up bits of Churchill's speeches so it sounded like Churchill was declaring peace in the middle of the actual war. Kind of like saying, you know, the mainstream media, the fake news, and AI, these are all very important components in the propaganda machine. So he worked at the ministry for 2 years, then left, feeling like he wasn't going to make any useful change through this government position. So he goes back to writing. And he then writes Animal Farm, which is a metaphor for the elites controlling the working class. Controlling the proletariats, like farmers on a farm. And it was Orwell's warning about trusting the communist Soviet Union, who at the time were allies with Britain and USA during World War II, right? So it was anti-communism. But what people forget is that Orwell was anti-totalitarianism. He was anti-fascism and anti-communism. And he says that art is very political, even saying that there shouldn't be politics in art is a political statement. He was also anti-capitalist as well. He said, because he said this contributed to inequalities. And he said that we're told to multiply our wants versus enjoying the things we already have. But if we just liked what we have and enjoyed, and he says, enjoying the return of spring, then our future could be better, because then you're not in this sort of fear-based dominance system and you're more of a state of abundance. You know, you're in a state of abundance when you're like, hey, you know, the sun is rising again today. What a beautiful day this is. Versus the capitalist thing, which is like, don't you want, your friends got the brand new car. Don't you want the brand new car? You better start slicing throats to make that happen. So while he's away, he goes off to write about World War II. All right. But while he's gone, his wife Irene tragically dies from a medical procedure. And Orwell turns out to be a deadbeat dad. He gives up their adopted son that they had so he can go do some more writing. So not a perfect guy. Definitely not a good father. And he's writing and he's talking about how language can corrupt thought, because there's power in words, of course. And that political conformity is a form of reduced consciousness. And we talked about this major theme in 1984. This idea about reducing the size of the dictionary through newspeak in order to reduce the range of consciousness. That's what it's all about. That's why they don't like mind-expanding drugs. That's why they don't like sex. It's because they need to limit the potential for consciousness. So he gets a lesion from his maybe tuberculosis. Starts bleeding. He reaches out to a neighbor lady and a bunch of other people to try to marry him, because he needs a partner now, and he's like, you can have the royalties from the book sales. Nobody wants to take him up on his offer with his bloody ulcer. They're like, step, bro. I don't want the money from your little Wiegand peer book, you know? So Orwell, he actually rekindles with his adopted son, goes into seclusion with his kid, and he writes 1984. And this would turn out to be his final attempt. Obviously, his biggest book, biggest contribution to the world of literature. It was his final attempt to warn people about totalitarianism. And during this time, he's suffering from his body breaking down from the tuberculosis, allegedly, maybe. And it may have influenced a lot of the dark sceneries of 1984. He finishes his final draft and he collapses. And he has to go to the hospital. And he also finds a woman to finally marry him now that he's dying in the hospital. And he dies in 1950, with 1984 being his final book, his final work, his final warning that comes through his characters, right? Very reminiscent of Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut, his final film. He finishes the final edit and dies before it can sort of get released. And this is where, you know, the scariest quote from 1984. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. So that's the story of George Orwell. It looks like he's a fascinating figure. I'm sure the book is great. It's like a 600-page biography book. I ain't got time for that, but I'm sure it's worth reading. So now the real question is, is 1984 happening, right? Because we obviously don't want that. That, you know, the whole term Orwellian is a warning about us sliding into some of this totalitarian ideas. Orwell said that 1984 could very well happen, and we're currently at the 76th anniversary of the release of the book. So we need to look at these terms like newspeak and the term woke, because words get hijacked. They get redefined. They even get inverted sometimes. This is something we see with the Dark Enlightenment. And Orwell was saying, he was warning us, that if you control the language, you can control thought itself. Right? There's power in words. And this is done in 1984 through newspeak and doublethink. In 1984, the state uses misinformation to support their goals. So when you hear stuff is fake news, is basically the state trying to say that, look, the mainstream media is using misinformation for your enemy's goals, the leftist goals, right? So therefore, you need to believe us. So, you see this stuff with like the Epstein list, which is now supposedly a hoax, and it was made by, you know, Obama and Clinton and all kinds of crazy stuff, right? And we're in this state, this post-truth state, where people believe what they want to believe at this point. And there is no authoritative source, because if you say, well, you know, the Washington Post released it, people will be like, well, that's a leftist magazine. Okay. Now, the inversion of words and terms is something I talked about in the Dark Enlightenment series, right? I talked about Liberation Day being a day of enslavement, by eating at the freedom of retirement, by crashing the economy and raising taxes through tariffs on the American population, which was not supposed to happen. They're supposed to lower the price of groceries. It's wiping out small businesses and small farms, which is great news for BlackRock and, you know, Great Reset stuff. And then you, right off the bat, we had RFK Jr. eating McDonald's on the plane and begging people to take the measles vax. You know, I can't say those words, stabby jabbies, stabby jabbers. You know, you get what I'm saying. Protesting is considered terrorism, right? I always say people were worried about the Second Amendment. It's the First Amendment. It's the freedom of speech. And that is being shut down on campuses because people are protesting against what's going on in Gaza and the blue and whites and stuff. So it's like very much inversion. What's up is down, what's good is evil. It's pure Gnosticism. It's alchemy. It's magical spells. You know, it's that whole thing. And I experienced this firsthand. I used to use the term to sign off on my show to saying, I used to say stay woke, which used to mean stay vigilant of the control systems. But unironically, I believe purposefully, got hijacked by a different control system which entered the chat, called QAnon, to meaning that whatever, you know, whatever's demonized, to demonize things by calling it woke, right? And it's always a dig at like leftist stuff, which they deserve to be picked on because they say crazy stuff sometimes. But the term woke didn't always mean that, you know, it came from Black culture as a way of saying like, hey, wake up to what's going on. And I'm going to do a quick little side detour because this is an issue I you know, it's personal to me because I had to change my whole sign off. I like the term. I like the term stay woke. But woke became such a toxic term. It's like I had to bail on that. And woke is a term used to now cancel people, erase people, vaporize, as we would say in 1984. But it used to be a warning against oppression. Howard Stern got into a bit of controversy because he said something was woke. And they talked about this. This term woke in Washington Post, you know, ironically. And there's, they talk about here, it says, there's a bit of etymology about a word that everyone's been using, but few have gotten quite right. The word is woke, which in an appropriation akin to using the expression the man, when one is the man, has been mistakenly and purposely misused by everyone from Bill Maher to neo-Nazis. You've probably seen or heard it employed as an adjective, as in stay woke. But what does woke mean exactly? When used to describe a state or being of thinking, many who lightly toss around the word today, including people who claim to embody it or those who wield it as a pejorative for progressives, would be surprised to learn that woke originated in the deepest trenches of Black nationalism. Black leaders have been calling on Black people to wake up for decades. To the first users of the word, it meant recognizing racial subjugation committed by whites. Thus, a white YouTuber or a liberal congressperson cannot, by the literal definition, be woke. In fact, wokeness was originally applied to U.S. blacks who had been mentally conditioned into philosophical slumber by centuries of oppression, intimidation, miseducation, and social frustration. The earliest common coinage came from the Nation of Islam, which was founded in Detroit in 1930. In the nation's cosmology, Black Americans' state of mental sleep could be remedied by a spiritual awakening reminiscent of Jesus' physical awakening of Lazarus from the dead. The minister termed the so-called Negroes, quote, mentally dead, 1937, black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, who advocated that black Americans physically return to Africa, was a strong proponent of a mental return to the mother continent before physical repatriation could take place. Quote, "We are going to emancipate ourselves from mental slavery," Garvey said. "For though others may free the body, none but ourselves can free the mind." In 1938, blues singer Huddy Ledbetter recommended black people best stay woke, keep their eyes open. There was no mention of white allies doing so, since whites were never put to mental sleep. Nation of Islam minister Malcolm X later criticized Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. for his "I Have a Dream" speech, insisting the civil rights leader could be dreaming only if he were asleep. Yet even King in 1965 gave a commencement address at Oberlin College in which he said, "There's nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution. The great challenge facing every individual graduating today is to remain awake." By 1970, the black nationalist proto-rappers The Last Poets recorded their tune, "Wake Up, N-Word." In the 1972 play Garvey Lives, playwright Barry Beckham wrote, "I've been sleeping all my life, and now that Mr. Garvey done woke me up, I'm going to stay woke." In Spike Lee's 1988 movie School Days, the final lines feature the campus activist Dap, portrayed by Lawrence Fishburne, screaming, "Wake up." Side note, also kind of what he tells Neo about waking up from the Matrix. His admonishment was for black people to unify rather than be divided along lines of skin complexion. None of this applied to white filmgoers. In 2016, BET aired a documentary about contemporary activism called Stay Woke. Woke entered the Oxford English Dictionary in 2017, 80 years after Garvey's aforementioned exhortation. People started using the phrase woke bay as a term of endearment. And in 2020, Essence Magazine named its Woke 100. None of this had anything to do with whiteness. Yet woke flowed into the U.S. parlance, bandied about across ethnic lines despite its origins. David Brooks, the white New York Times columnist, for instance, wrote in 2017, "To be woke is to be radically aware and justifiably paranoid. It is to be cognizant of the rot pervading the power structures. This happened as police and terrorist shootings of unarmed black people were making headlines. As protests and movements against the violence grew larger, more opponents adopted woke as an insult." In his final days as Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo tweeted, "Wokeism, multiculturalism, all the isms, they're not who America is." In a diabolical twist, even white supremacists started describing themselves as woke, meaning politically aware. We're a long way from the days of Malcolm X, who said there will come a time when black people wake up and become intellectually independent enough to think. The operative word being black, not wake. Keep that in mind the next time you hear woke uttered as a slur or a synonym for politicized, or the next time you're tempted to invoke it yourself. So in conclusion to that, I apparently appropriated the term. I didn't know that. But that's not why I stopped using it. I stopped using it because it became a divisive word, a lightning rod to make people assume a certain agenda, right? And that's what happened with the whole conspiracy movement. It got wrecked from the QAnon stuff, right? Which I believe was done by design, on purpose. Now let's move on to surveillance. America's got a good amount of surveillance through things we know about: the Patriot Act, the NSA Prism program, the Bumble Hive in Utah, which is storing just massive amounts of our data, and now the plans for Palantir to compile and collect hundreds of data points on Americans, which will be used to possibly create a social credit score system like China, or a precog crime deterrence model like in Minority Report. And you'll notice how, and I read about this in one of my Dark Enlightenment episodes, I ran through all the data points, and it's just hundreds, I mean, it's everything. They could figure out, you know, if TikTok can figure out what you like through an algorithm, trust me that this Palantir database will figure out what you're going to do and what you're about, so they can keep an extra close eye on you, on the subversives. And notice how it's going to happen through a joint venture of government with capitalism, right? Your Palantirs, your big tech, Google, Apple, Meta, and TikTok. And the Palantir surveillance system has been in the works since 9/11, right? You notice Obama didn't shut down the Patriot Act. He kept it going. So that was just always supposed to be part of the plan. And this is why people think that there's, you know, the left and the right are the same thing, because they ultimately take us down one path, which is true. We talked about this Dark Enlightenment series concept of Palantir, the term coming from the Lord of the Rings, the Palantiri crystal spheres, the bad guys using surveillance on the good guys, right? Because architects of the Dark Enlightenment, Curtis Yarvin, Peter Thiel, they're sci-fi nerds. These nerds are going to kill us. I say that and I mean that. And they're doing it actively. In March of 2025, Trump's executive order called for the federal government to compile multiple stovepipe data sets into a massive Palantir managed system. Hundreds of data points compiling and creating profiles of each of us. Why? I mean, you'd have to ask Trump and Palantir, right? That requires a lot of trust that they're not going to do anything bad about that. And in a way, it seems like the Epstein files cover up could be something used to distract us from the Palantir surveillance state in a way. Like, sometimes I think about that. Keeps us arguing about that instead of talking about what could actually be more dangerous to all of us. And those telescreens that we saw in 1984, those could be in our pockets. Those could be the smartphone. We might already have those. You know, that's what that NSA Prism thing was saying, is like they can jack in and listen. You talk about something with your friends and the next thing you know, you're getting ads for it on your social media. That's interesting. We've all somehow become okay with the phones listening to us and showing us ads on our conversations, private conversations. We've already chosen convenience over privacy. And that NSA Prism program that talked about the intelligence capabilities to activate the cameras and the phones to spy on us was what's going on. So yes, check. We're already there with the surveillance element. Now we're talking about the truth, facts, and the Ministry of Truth. We're in the postmodern relativism era where we don't agree on what is real. And a great example of that is that, you know, 50th birthday Epstein book. And, you know, Trump said, oh, I would never draw a naked woman. I didn't even know Epstein. And then the House Oversight Committee releases the actual book and the image and Donald Trump's signature. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not my signature. Okay. And we see countries like Russia using state-run media like RT to push narratives like we saw in 1984. And you see all this weird struggle of billionaires trying to buy out the mainstream media or to have bias experts. You know, that was the big element of South Park. That's why they were making fun of Trump, because that was the whole deal, is what's his name's son, Larry Ellison's son, basically buying Paramount and CBS so that they have to, you know, the conditions include favorable stuff for Dear Leader, and they're kicking a lot of them out, like AP and PBS, kicking them out of the White House, defunding them, all this stuff, right? And replacing them with content creators. And they are the new state-sponsored media. All these podcasters and, you know, bloggers and Twitter users, this is your new state-sponsored media. And it sucks, because that was the fallout of people not trusting the mainstream media. We said, oh, we don't trust the mainstream media. I'm going to follow this person on Twitter. They're independent. Turns out they're not. There was that, remember the thing called Sodagate? I mean, like, it just goes on and on. Remember the white binders? Oh, the most transparent president ever. Oh, okay. Here's stuff that we already released years ago. And then it was a hoax. I mean, like, it goes on and on. I go on all day about that. But this is why people were concerned about Stephen Colbert getting canceled on his late night show. His handlers at CBS and Paramount trying to make a merger happen with Skydance, Larry Ellison's kid. So another billionaire is like the third richest man in the world or something. So they needed Trump's FCC to approve it, but Colbert was on air criticizing them for paying Trump a $16 million settlement just days before he got canceled. And this stemmed from, you know, Trump sued 60 Minutes for deceptive editing of its Kamala Harris interview, which the allegation is that Trump is forcing CBS to move further to the right to prevent further lawsuits. And, you know, take from that what you will, freedom of press, freedom of speech, whatever. But it's actually more nefarious, right? Skydance is owned by, you know, David Ellison. Larry Ellison is a mega donor, the world's second richest man, excuse me, behind Elon Musk. And furthermore, he got his wealth from Oracle, the software company funded by the CIA. And Larry's funding the whole $8 billion merger, and he's going to have a lot of control. And I mean, it's what it is. And note how part of the Trump lawsuit included having CBS publish pro-Trump propaganda. Right? This is the 1984 playbook. You can no longer critique the state. It will be punished, and you will be met with vaporizing. You will be erased. The Epstein cover-up is a memory hole situation. Massive cognitive dissonance going on right now, right? Trump ran on releasing the Epstein files for years, as did all of his supporters, which is why he's in hot water for not releasing it. And they're trying to memory hole it and say, yeah, there's no such thing. And social media is constantly controlling who sees what with the algorithm through big tech oligarchs, Silicon Valley nerds, literally controlling what we see, torching truther accounts, certain truther accounts, mind you. Oh, you know, Isaac's dangerous misinformation. Is it that, or is it because I'm not tied in with some big lobbyist, some big company that's got lawyers involved with YouTube? I think that's more like it. I think the fact that some truthers can openly talk about, there's one guy on there, he's got a big old mustache, you know who he is. He was on there talking about stabby jabbies, not even using stabby jabby, using the real term, talking about pew pews and not using the pew pew term, using the real term. That's fine. Okay. It's because these people have huge funding behind them. It's dangerous to have an independent voice. It's dangerous now. And that's why they torch accounts, right? That's why I had two YouTubes get torched, a Vimeo get torched. Like, sure, you can find me on the... Sure, I exist. But, like, the problem is, like, people tend to stay on the platform they're on, right? It's like trying to get people to click off of social media to come listen to the podcast. Like, it's not really how it works generally. They know what they're doing, right? It's an attention economy. Then you got war, right? War is always a thing. 1984, it's perpetual, constant conflicting news of who's our ally, who's our enemy. And, everyone's confused. They're always fueling up new enemies. And this is like the blue and whites in Palestine is a great example. Russia and Ukraine. We have some confusion, like who's our allies and who's not. Both of these were going to end. Trump ran and said on day one, both of these wars, I'm going to end both of them. And since then, they haven't ended. We've also bombed Iran and a Venezuelan boat, and who knows. Then you got sexy time. In 1984, sex is repressed because the state doesn't want you to love anything or anyone more than Big Brother. And one could argue that there's already control over our sex lives. You know, they're already trying it. It's the Project 2025 stuff. They want to permanently ban smut. They've already banned it in a lot of states, including my great state of Utah, the nanniest state of them all. They are overturning Roe v. Wade. That's not a commentary on that, but they did do that. They demonize LGBTQ lifestyles. They push for the nuclear family to be the only situation that exists, and supposedly it could be tracking dating apps, which is also kind of 1984 in that sex is only for hookups, not romance, right? They don't mind hookup culture. You can't fall in love though, and sex can only be used for procreation, which is kind of how Elon Musk has been talking. About, remember, he's got 100 kids and he talks about how we need to procreate and populate the planet and all this stuff. And you could argue that promiscuous songs like WAP reinforce the idea of sex being a function more so than an act of making love or an emotional connection, because the family structure is dangerous to the control system. All right. Now, the final talk is doublethink and cancel culture, because in 1984, the kids are snitching on the parents, and this is an early form of cancel culture. And it's critical to a totalitarian state as much as doublethink is used to erase opposition, right? So, for example, they'll say how we need to cancel or censor someone in order to protect free speech, which obviously doesn't make any sense, right? But that's exactly what Curtis Yarvin said with the Dark Enlightenment movement. I mean, almost verbatim. he criticizes the free speech in America and says, oh, it's dangerous. Yet the only reason he can talk about overthrowing democracy is because of our freedom of speech. That's interesting. And Doublethink is also, you know, knowing certain people are on the Epstein list, yet still thinking they're going to take down everyone on the Epstein list. Okay. So now what, right? Let's zoom out. So what's all my complaining and crying about here? In conclusion, to reiterate, Orwell wasn't just saying that the communists and the leftists are bad. He wasn't saying that conservatives or the fascists are bad. He was saying the extreme right and fascism is a problem. The extreme left and the communists is a problem because both of those tend towards totalitarianism, which is exactly what David Icke talks about in his books, his totalitarian tiptoe warnings. And he talks about it being a circle and communism and fascism meet at the end of the line. And the news today makes us think that any kind of moderate belief system on the left or right is, you know, not a stance that people have. And that, you know, the when in reality, that's the answer. Moderation is the answer. Being a little left or a little right, that's the answer. It's when you're calling for the, you know, the genocidal extermination of all people on the left or right, like that's when you get into totalitarianism. And there's been rhetoric, right? There's been rhetoric, deep state Donnie calling the left vermin who are poisoning the country. Like, that's dangerous. That's exactly what contributes to the 1984 future. It's exactly what Orwell saw in Spain. This was part of the propaganda to get people to hate others, right? They got the whole country mad at Los Angeles during these ICE protests. We saw these AI videos being released. And people didn't know what was real. And they thought, oh, my God, these protesters, these ICE protesters are violent. They're burning up cars. No, that was AI. That was all manipulation. Right? They send in the National Guard and the Marines now to the cities against their own American population. That's also 1984. It's militarized suppression of opposition. And look, this is just my take. By all means, please. Listen to another book club from someone else. I have many biases, as I talked about in my 3-hour Who is Isaac Weishaupt episode a year ago. So my perspective could be off. You know, maybe Alex Jones will read 1984 and do a book club. I don't think so. I think he is more based on emotion and banging on the desk than he is reading and researching and trying to find out what people were saying. Maybe someone else could read it and be like, no, Isaac, you're way wrong. I'm going to refute everything you're saying. I think I'm correct here in my views. I know I'm correct in my views. But I know that doesn't sit well with a lot of truther types, right? Professor Anna Pasalka, she had a course I took called The Original Awakeners. And she's doing other courses too, by the way, which I highly recommend her courses. And she walked through Plato's Republic and its influence on books like 1984. And the Republic looks at ideas of morality and it's arguing about the best way to make an ethical government. And this is also where the allegory of the cave parable comes from. And it had the idea of a noble lie, lying to the citizens for their own benefit, right? Which is a slippery concept. It's got eugenics vibes. Only certain elites are worthy of the gnosis, the knowledge. It's got very much dark enlightenment in it. Plato thought that people really are happy being told what their role would be in life. And Professor Pasalka said that Hannah Arendt wrote a book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. This was a nonfiction version of 1984 about her observations of language shifting and changing before totalitarianism took over. And she had also written a book about the banality of evil, people following rules that makes it feel like evil is, it gets normalized. Like, oh, that's just the rules. Yeah. You know, we need to arrest families that are working and ship them to, you know, prisons in other countries without due process. That's normal. That's fine. That's okay. Because propaganda is part of distorting reality. They come up with enemies to make, this is the 2 minutes of hate, to make us hate immigrants. Because they're like, well, they broke the rules. Because originally they were like, oh, we're going to deport all these criminals or murderers or rapists. And it's like, okay, I mean, I'm receptive to that. Like, if you're in this country murdering and raping, like, you should be in prison. But that's not what they did. They're going to Home Depot. They're arresting people at Hyundai plant, working plants, people with jobs, right? That's where a lot of our farm laborers come from, our meatpacking plants. If you ever read Fast Food Nation, he talks about this. And Edward Bernays is part of the system. We did a three-parter on Edward Bernays called The Century of the Self years ago, 2018, I think. Because propaganda is about distorting reality, breaking down trust for the aims and the goals of the elites, making people cynical so that they're easier to control. And there's something concerning, because in 1984, everyone is lonely because nobody can be their true selves to anyone else. Because Hannah Arendt says that loneliness is a key condition to totalitarian regimes. They want us to be lonely. Just like in 1984, you can't have a family, a spouse, your kids, right? So, you know, I was one of the only truthers the whole time warning against Q and MAGA and all this stuff. And you see how that entire thing is proving out to be like darker than advertised, right? A lot of people were like, oh, drain the swamp, all this stuff, right? And, you know, there's talk about pardoning Ghislaine Maxwell, reinventing the Epstein list to get rid of political enemies, which is very terrifying because that's the exact 1984 totalitarian playbook Orwell was warning us about. And finally, if you want more, there's a new documentary, I haven't seen it yet, called Orwell 2+2=5 that goes through Orwell's works, and it apparently has parallels with today's society. So if you want more, like, there's another resource, and I haven't seen it yet, but I definitely will watch it when I get the time to watch it. And, you know, I could be wrong. I could be very wrong in my interpretation. I'm not some kind of literary scholar, all right? I just know what I know. I know what I see, and that's why I would hope you listen to me. Not listen to me, like, follow me, but, like, consider my ideas and my opinions. And that's why I appreciate and love my community so much. You guys are the absolute best. The people that agree with me, I appreciate you finding me and staying connected. The people who disagree with me, I almost respect you more. You know, my MAGA people out there that stick in there, right? Because I lob a lot of critiques that way. And the fact that you're still hanging out and listening, and I try to be respectful with it, right? Because I do respect people's opinions. Like I always talk about, like, almost my entire group of friends are right-wingers. We don't agree on much when it comes to politics and society. But that's okay. Like, I love them dearly. They're great people, as I'm sure my listeners are too as well. So I do appreciate people considering this. And I am a flawed enough human to say I could have some of these things wrong. I could be way wrong. You could talk to me in 5 years and I could be totally on the other side of the spectrum and be like, dude, I was so manipulated and wrong about all these ideas. But that's where I stand today. That's my opinion. And I appreciate you taking the time to listen to it. So thank you so much for your support. Now, if you like the show, the options for you, you can review it. Give me a 5-star to combat the 1-star haters. You could share it with a friend. That's the most helpful way, because I unfortunately get harassed on the algorithms and all this stuff. So if you could share with a friend who's into this, maybe start them with part one of 1984 if you want to open that can of worms with them. And the ultimate level of support is to become a supporter on Patreon, Apple Premium, or my exclusive VIP section. You can check out and compare all three platforms at IlluminatiWatcher.com. Hit the VIP menu tab up top and check them out. I throw every perk known to man at you guys on those platforms. So please consider that if you really do love the show. You'll unlock hundreds of bonus episodes. Okay. All right. That's enough grifting. Thank you so much for your support. Till next time, stay positive.